come up on a tight wire.
I'm sitting across from my good friend Benjamin Alita Sines.
And I'm sitting across in Studio B from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
That's funny because I am not in Studio B right now. I'm in Studio A. No wonder you look so distant today. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, when our guest will be Steve Yarbrough, who was actually one of my very first fiction writing teachers at California State University, Fresno. And we're going to talk about his new novel, The Realm of Last Chances. Isn't that a great title?
It is a great title. And I'm really looking forward to speaking to him. And you know what? I think I'm really looking forward to your reflection on mentors and writers.
Right. You know, because Steve Yarbrough is one of my very first mentors. And as I was reading his book and preparing for this interview, it made me start think about how important mentors are to writers. I mean, I think every good writer, every successful writer has a mentor that they claim is responsible for them being where they are. Yours is Denise Levertov.
Yes, that's right. So I'm really looking forward to your reflection in this week's Poetic License, and please don't screw it up.
I'll try not to. And for our poem of the week, we have...
I'm going to read a Lorca poem entitled The City That Doesn't Sleep.
Oh, I thought that was a Frank Sinatra song. New York is the city that, whatever, however it goes. Okay, I'm sorry. No singing. You told me that.
No singing.
When Ben and I, you know, we're roommates for a while, he doesn't let me sing. He just, if I start singing, he says,
I don't let him tell bad jokes either. It's just awful. But I do now let him cook broccoli in the house.
But if I didn't let Ben tell bad jokes, we would never hear anything out of him. So I just have to let him do that. Anyway, it's going to be a great show. I'm really excited that Steve Yarbrough is going to join us. He's originally a Southern writer, but now he lives in right outside of Boston. He teaches at Emerson College, and this is going to be a great, great, great opportunity for me to talk to one of my mentors.
Yeah, it's going
to
be great.
All right, join us. Stick around, and we're going to talk to Steve Yarbrough.
Stay tuned. This week on our show, we have Steve Yarbrough, who is the author of 9 books. His most recent novel, The Realm of Last Chances, was recently published by Knopf. He has been a finalist for the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters, and he has won the Massachusetts Book Award. His 2006 novel, The End of California, also by Knopf, was also a finalist for the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters Award. Welcome to our show, Steve.
It's an honor to talk to you guys.
You know, I was telling Ben earlier that when I had a radio show at Fresno State for a little time, you were the first guest I had on.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, you hadn't had a novel yet. You had just a one collection of stories, Family Man, which I still have on my shelf today. And you read a story from the Best American Stories of, you know, whatever year it was at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, and look, they put your story last because they saved the best for the last. And you go, Dan, it's alphabetized.
You were being kind.
Well, you know, you've always been one of my mentors, one of my favorite writers, and one of my favorite people. And I am really excited about The Realm of Last Chances. And this is what number novel from Knopf?
It's, let's see, it's the 5th novel that I've done with Knopf, and it's my 6th novel overall.
Wow, and it's a wonderful story about, well, there's a lot of characters, but I guess we could say that it focuses on Kristen, Kel, and Matt. And it's also a breakthrough novel for you in the sense that it's the first novel that I know of, I think I've read most of yours, that doesn't take place in the South.
Yeah, it is. I kind of felt like I needed a break from Mississippi. And when I moved up here, I found myself falling in love with the landscape, and it just felt like, you know, it was something I wanted to write about.
You know, what's interesting is when you were in California, you were in Fresno for, I don't know, 10 years or so. But when you were in California, oftentimes you would write something set in California, but it would be a Southern character in California. This time, it doesn't even seem that you have any Southern characters. Your Cal is from California. I don't remember where Christian's from, but Matt is from the East Coast. Did that feel weird for you?
Initially, it did. But I felt like I knew Cal. I knew guys like Cal during the time I was in Central Valley. And by the way, Daniel, your clock has been kind to me. I was actually out there for 21 years.
You were? Oh, my gooseness. Wow.
So I felt like I got to know people in the valley. And Kristen is from a little town in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Oddly enough, I've spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania, so I felt like I knew that environment. And Matt is from a town like the one I lived in. So I felt pretty secure with those three, other mm-hmm. than, you know, just the general fear that you feel every day when you sit down and look at a blank screen.
Right. Well, Cal is for me, I really like Cal's character. One of the characteristics that Cal has that strikes me is he always carries his Bosey speaker everywhere he goes, so he could listen to his music, and he always strums at his guitar and drinks his whiskey. And you know what? I couldn't help but see a little bit of you in Cal.
Well, I've been told that before. You know, I guess the point of departure is that the other thing Cal does is he does construction
right.
for a living. And I'm one of those people who honestly cannot even handle a hammer or a screwdriver.
Oh, that so, surprises me.
Yeah, so I had to imagine that part of his character.
Steve, what got you into writing to begin with?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, my family were small-time farmers in Mississippi, and I could tell that life was really hard for them. They didn't own much land, and they worked all day and would just come in half dead at night. So I knew that there was nothing wrong with that life except that I didn't want it. And I first wanted to be a musician, and I figured out I wasn't quite good enough to be professional. And I played football for a while and got, you know, college scholarship. But again, I wasn't going to be good enough to go on. The only other thing I'd always loved was reading. So when I was about 18 or 19, people asked me, "What are you going to do?" I started saying, "I'm going to be a writer." And I really didn't know anything about what it took to be a writer. But when I got to college, I met some people who were helpful. A professor named Evans Harrington had written one novel when he was a young man. And then I met Willie Morris, who had been editor of Harper's Magazine and had written several books. And they both told me that they saw some talent, but that I was going to have to work really hard. And so that's what I did. I just sat down and started writing horrible stuff. But after a while, it began to get a little bit better, and I could stand to read it.
Did you go on to get an MFA?
I did get an MFA at the University of Arkansas, and I was fortunate because I had good teachers. I had a man named John Cleland Holmes, who had been one of Jack Kerouac's best friends, and actually I think John wrote the first Beat novel. William Harrison was important to me, a novelist and screenwriter who had had quite a few successes. And then I had classes. I was in a class at least twice, I think, with John Dufresne and Lee Martin. And those two guys between them now have probably published about 21 or 22 books. So I had good people to learn from, and not just the teachers, but the other students as well.
Were you well-versed in Southern literature?
You know, when I went to college, and I went to Ole Miss, so it was the town that William Faulkner was from, mm-hmm. that's the first time I had read Southern writers. And I went through a huge Faulkner phase, and I still think Faulkner was probably, all things considered, our greatest novelist. Read a lot of Flannery O'Connor, read Eudora Welty a little bit later. But by and large, my favorite writers have never been Southern writers.
Hmm. Who had they been?
I read a lot of Eastern European writers. And people think that I've been doing that because I'm married to a woman from Poland. But in fact, I started reading those writers before I met her.
Maybe that's why you're married to a woman from Poland, the other way around.
Well, you know, she was the first Polish person I'd ever met, and I walked right over to her and asked her, "What do you think of Tadeusz Konwicki?" And she almost dropped dead, you know. partly because of the way that word sounded when it came out of my mouth, I suspect. But I read a lot of Eastern Europeans, and still do, read a lot of Irish writers, read a lot of Latin American writers. So I think that probably served me well because, you know, those writers from the South, especially Faulkner and O'Connor, they're so distinctive that, you know, imitating them is perilous, it seems to me.
Right, right. Very perilous.
Yeah, in fact, when I first started writing, I was in your class, and I wrote... I wrote a story that you had to say, Danny, let Faulkner be Faulkner.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you did.
Well, it wasn't bad advice.
No, it wasn't. I still think of that to this day. I want to ask you a little bit about your use of point of view. There's many characters in here, and the point of view is omniscient in such a way even that sometimes when we're rooted in one character, the reader can see something that the character doesn't see. But you have this... short passage that I want to read when all three of the characters come together for the first time. And you do something really interesting with the point of view that I noticed you do a lot in your short stories, too. And I've tried to steal this from you many, many times unsuccessfully. But they're all meeting for the first time. And then the sentence says, though each of them in the months ahead would recall the exact remark differently, all three noted that his initial reaction upon seeing them together was to assume disaster had struck.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful use of point of view. It doesn't really come out of the story, but it kind of, it's a, oh my God, there's going to be something that's going to happen between these three people.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you two writers who have influenced me a lot with point of view, and sometimes, especially with the first of these, it's not even so much his handling of point of view as it is his ability to constantly vary the distance between us and the characters. And that's the Irish writer, William Trevor, especially in his short stories, but in his novels as well. He's constantly shifting the ground under your feet. And another writer, a Texas writer actually, very different kind of writer, but Larry McMurtry is also, he plays fast and loose with perspective. And you can see it in, you know, in a novel like Lonesome Dove, where both of those writers are refreshingly free from having a lot of rules imposed on them by creative writing workshops.
Right.
So I just decided at a certain point I was going to make up my own rules for everything that I write, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
We're going to be winding up here, but I wanted to tell a story about you, or I wanted to say something about you. Do you know that to this day, when I go into a bookstore I've never been in, and sometimes even some I've never been in, and I walk the aisles, I think of you. I feel you. I feel your presence, because when you were my professor, your first book had just come out, Family Man.
Right.
And you were very excited about it. I mean, I think you were hired because of that book. And I remember I was in the bookstore at Fresno State, and I was a new writer. I was very excited, and I just wanted to look through books. But I saw you. And if you've never seen Steve Yarbrough, he's an incredibly tall man. And back then, you had hair almost all the way down to your butt. It was long, long hair. And you were probably only in your late 20s, I would imagine, or mid-20s. But I saw you walking around and passing by where they had your books, and you were just kind of like looking at them out of the corner of your eye. And I thought, oh, man, that is so beautiful, because I saw that you were a new writer, and I didn't even know, you know, what it was like to be a writer, but a new writer seeing your books on the shelf probably for the first time, and it was a really exciting moment for you.
Yeah, it was, and that really hasn't changed for me. When I go in a bookstore, and I'm in a bookstore every few days, you know, somewhere, I always look. You know, I look to see if they're there, and sometimes they're there, and they'll be beside some of Richard Yates's novels. And, you know, he was a big inspiration to
me. Oh, that's awesome.
It always makes me happy.
Yeah, it's because of you I read Richard Yates, but I do the same thing. And thank you very much for appearing on our show, Steve Yarbrough.
Yes, thanks, Steve, for being on Words on a Wire.
And please pick up his novel, The Realm of Last Chances, by Knopf, still in hardback, and wonderful story. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, guys.
I'm going to read a poem by a poet really who needs no introduction, Federico García Lorca, the great Spanish poet. City that does not sleep. In the sky, there is nobody asleep. Nobody, nobody. Nobody is asleep. The creatures of the moon sniff and prowl about their cabins. The living iguanas will come and bite the men who do not dream. And the man who rushes out with his spirit broken will meet on the street corner the unbelievable alligator quiet beneath the tender protest of the stars. Nobody is asleep on earth. Nobody, nobody. Nobody is asleep. In a graveyard far off, there is a corpse who has moaned for 3 years because of a dry countryside on his knee. And that boy they buried this morning cried so much it was necessary to call out the dogs to keep him quiet. Life is not a dream. Careful, careful, careful. We fall down the stairs in order to meet the moist earth, or we climb to the knife edge of the snow with the voices of the dead dahlias. But forgetfulness does not exist. Dreams do not exist. Flesh exists. Kisses tie our mouths in a thicket of new veins, and whoever has pains will feel that pain forever, and whoever is afraid of death will carry it on his shoulders. One day, the horses will live in the saloons, and the enraged ants will throw themselves on the yellow skies that take refuge on the eyes of cows. Another day, we will watch the preserved butterflies rise from the dead. And still walking through a country of gray sponges and silent boats, we will watch our ring flash and roses spring from our tongue. Careful, be careful, be careful. The man who will still have marks of the claw and the thunderstorm. And that boy who cries because he has never heard of the invention of the bridge. Or that dead man who possesses now only his head and a shoe. We must carry them to the wall where the iguanas and the snakes are waiting, where the bear's teeth are waiting, where the mummified hand of the boy is waiting, and the hair of the camel stands on end with a violent blue shudder. Nobody is sleeping in the sky. Nobody, nobody, nobody is sleeping. If someone does close his eyes, a whip, boys, a whip. Let there be a landscape of open eyes and bitter wounds on fire. No one is sleeping in this world. No one, no one. I have said it before. No one is sleeping. But if someone grows too much moss on his temples during the night, open the stage trap doors so he can see in the moonlight the lying goblets and the poison and the skull of the theaters. That was Federico García Lorca's poem, City That Does Not Sleep. It was translated by Robert Bly.
A note about this poetic license by Daniel Chacon. It was recorded on a portable recorder while Daniel is away on a book tour for his newest collection of stories, Hotel Juarez.
My poetic license is about mentors, and it is inspired by Steve Yarbrough. You need a mentor. If you're going to be a Jedi, you need a Yoda. Or a Yoda need you will. Bob Dylan needed a Wordy Guthrie. Carl Jung needed a Freud. And Daniel Chacon, the fiction writer, needed a Steve Yarbrough. Not that I'm comparing myself to these historical figures, mind you, but I am a successful fiction writer. I made $500 off my writing last year. Yeah, that's enough for a bag of weed and a double-double at In-N-Out Burger. Steve Yarbrough is one of my mentors in fiction writing. Sometimes I even quote him when I'm addressing a class of fiction writing. A student might tell me he or she has an idea for a story, and I quote what Steve Yarbrough once said to me when I told him I had a story idea. That's your problem. A story shouldn't be about an idea. It should be about people. Artists need mentors. We need someone to not only encourage us about what we should do, but someone who will alert us about what we shouldn't do. Having a mentor is fundamental to our artistic development. I think we're all talented. I don't think we want to become fiction writers unless there's some sense that we're good at it. Bernard Malamud, one of my dead mentors, you should read his book on craft called Talking Horse. It's brilliant. Malamud says, "I write fiction because I'm good at it." I think students who study creative writing do so because they're good at it. Everyone wants to be a writer. We have a cultural belief that everyone has a book in them, which essentially means almost everyone dreams about publishing a book before they die. I think if you took a poll among 10 people, asking them if they write, 8 of them will say yes, they write, and they want to publish a book. And now with self-publishing and electronic media, anyone can, and unfortunately does, publish a book. But let's not talk about that category of writers. Let's talk about successful fiction writers like me. So successful that I got a royalty check for my first book last quarter that allowed me to buy what I always wanted. Lunch. Everyone wants to be a writer, but only writers who are good at it pursue it. But talent isn't enough. You need to learn your craft. And the mentoring process is fundamental to that process. Steve Yarbrough was one of my first writing mentors. When I read The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner for the very first time, I wrote a story called In the Valley of the Whale. This is right after I read Faulkner. I come from Fresno, which is in the Central Valley. And my story wasn't called The Valley of the Whale, but The Valley. Pretty clever, huh? I wanted to show how people in Fresno were living miserable lives because they were metaphorically avoiding the will of God, just like Jonah in the belly of the whale. But get this, the story was in the Valley of the Whale, W-A-I-L. Not whale, as in the big fish, but whale, as in a painful groan. So people in the valley in my story were whaling. Am I clever or what? If you look at the shape of the San Joaquin Valley, it does kind of look like a fish. In this story, there was a lot of pain, and my characters led anxious lives, and there was stream of conscious italicized sections, just like in the Quentin chapter in The Sound and the Fury, which was my favorite chapter. You know, and I was a new fiction writer. My BA was in political science. I was going to be a lawyer. So I had never seen stream of conscious or italics used the way that William Faulkner used them. It blew me away. The semester I read Sound and the Fury, I also had a seminar in fiction writing with Steve Yarbrough, and my story was called In the Valley of the Whale. It had a lot of Faulknerian techniques. I thought it was the most brilliant story ever written. I thought Yarbrough was going to pull me aside and say, "Danny, I got to say, in all my years of teaching, I have never seen a writer as talented and brilliant as you. Here," and he hands me the roll book, "you teach the class." I really thought it was that good. So I turned it in, and I waited that long, long week before the next class meeting when the workshop was going to discuss your story. Monday passes, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Each day moved along as slow as an elephant in high heels. But finally, the day came. I brought extra pens to class just in case anyone wanted my autograph. I was waiting for the discussion about my story, and when it got to mine, the students spoke, and most of them had goodwill. Unless you're in one of those vicious workshops where writers seem intent on killing each other, tearing each other apart. But this was a Steve Yarbrough class. Everyone had goodwill. They thought the story was great, and I had to agree with them. This is true. One student stood up on his desk and said, "It was one of the greatest American stories ever written. Absolutely phenomenal." But then Steve reminded me that the writer isn't supposed to talk about his own story, so I sat down. So we let the student speak, talk about the story, and when everyone said all they could, it was Steve's turn to talk. He looks at my story. He looks at me. He looks at the story. Back then, by the way, Steve was a young writer. He only had one book out, Family Men, a collection of stories. And he had long hair, really long hair down to his butt. And everyone in the English department thought he was cool. Because here's this big southern man, big as a football player with long hair and liberal and with a thick Georgia accent who writes fiction. Who couldn't love a guy like that? So Steve is holding my story. Everyone's quiet, waiting to hear what he has to say. He shakes his head. He looks right at me. All the students are looking at me. I'm thinking, here it comes. He's going to say you're brilliant. Danny, I don't know how you did it, but I don't feel like I can teach you anything. I'm not qualified. You need to get up in front of the class right now, Danny Chacon. But that's not what he said. He looks at my story. He looks at me. The students are looking at me, and he says, Danny, just let Faulkner be Faulkner. End of discussion. That was it. He didn't tell me how amazing was my detail, how deep my characters, how brilliant were my multiple levels of thematic depth. He didn't say, like a good mentor should, metaphors be with you. And I was devastated. I thought, that southern boy don't know crap. When I get mad, I get kind of ghetto and I lose my grammar. He don't know nothing, man. But after giving it some distance, I reread In the Valley of the Well, and I thought, damn, this is a really bad Faulkner imitation. And that's the thing. If we read Faulkner, if we allow ourselves to be too influenced by his voice, we think Faulkner's language is taking over our story. But what really takes over the story is our perception of the language. And it becomes a bad imitation. Steve was right. As much as I hated him for the next 48 hours, by the time the class met again, I knew he was right. I listened to him, and he became one of the most important mentors in my artistic development. Even today, I still consider him one of the best mentors I've had. Even if does he talk with a weird accent? This is Daniel Chacon for Words on a Wire.
I'm Benjamin Alita Sainz.
And I'm Daniel Chacon.
And thank you for listening to another great show. Thank you, Steve Yarborough, and your reflection on mentors and writers.
Mwah. You know, Ben, I have to admit, I may not have said this in the thing, but you really are one of my mentors, and I appreciate everything I've learned from you. You're a great friend, a great writer, and a great co-host.
Well, thank you, Daniel.
And thanks for reading that Lorca poem. And now that we are in the midst of a love fest, we'd like to invite you to join us next week at the same time for another edition of Words on a Wire.
12 noon every Sunday on KTEP 88.5.
And don't forget, the next book you read
will save your life. I'm up on a tight